I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
This episode is brought to you by Paramount Plus. Get in, loser! Mean Girls is now streaming on Paramount Plus. Join Katie Heron as she meets the plastics and Tina Fey's new twist on the modern classic. Get ready for more of the rumors, backstabbing, and jokes you loved from the original movie with some fetch surprises. Rated PG-13. Wear pink and head to ParamountPlus.com to try it free.
What's going on, everybody? Hope you are having a wonderful week so far. So this week on the podcast is a special one. Victor Calderon, I don't really need to give him much introduction. I'm pretty sure you do know who he is. If not, you're going to find out all about him. New York DJ legend, has been in the game since the 90s. Amazing DJ. A very, very nice guy as well. I love this podcast. So without further ado, Victor Calderon. Victor Calderon, what's going on, man?
Hey.
How's things?
Things are great. Things are really good. Back in Brooklyn on a gloomy day. It's been raining here all morning, but things are good. Yeah.
I feel like Brooklyn is best when it's gloomy, if I'm honest. I don't know about you, but like, there's like the type, like spring and fall for me in New York itself is like the best time of the year.
I love it. I mean, I enjoy the summer, but yeah, there's just a feeling in the air, just different vibes. You can wear different clothes. You can break out that coat or, you know, hoodie or, yeah.
Exactly. And you're not sweating too much on the subway. I can't deal with the heat, man. I can't deal with it. How was your summer anyway?
It was nice. I mean, you know, coming back from what we've all been, going through, I guess, it was such a twisted year for everyone, but I had a little, bit of extra fuckery in there, with some personal shit that I went through. We can talk about it, but much better. To answer your question, the summer is definitely shaping up.
That's good, man. That's good. I met you on my first show back. I've obviously been a fan for years and kind of followed you as an artist and kind of knew one of the, like, you're like one of the very first guys or like one of the leading people from New York area that's just been in the scene for God knows how many years. and it's always been like amazing to see you just be still so part of the scene for so many years. I wanted to like get into like, I think I'm really interested about it, but also I'm sure everybody that's listening is really interested in what it was like when you first started back in the day. And when was that?
Oh man, we're gonna go back to the 80s.
Yeah, exactly.
to tap into that. I first started as a teenager. My older brother was a DJ.
Yeah.
So growing up, and we shared a bedroom, you know, growing up, we grew up in Brooklyn, in Bensonhurst, Brooklyn, Italian neighborhood. And yeah, we shared a bedroom, and, you know, I'll never forget the day that, like, he carried in a crate of records and two turntables on top, you know, and set up this setup in our room. And I was like, what are you doing? And then I would just, like, sit there and listen to him DJ, you know? And then, of course, I got into it. He taught me how to DJ. And then it became all about collecting vinyl. He would take me into the city with him. We'd jump on the train and go to all the record shops, Downtown Record, Vinyl Mania. And that became an obsession for me, just, like, you know, collecting vinyl.
Yeah.
So that's how I initially was introduced into DJing, into the DJing world. And then he took me to my first nightclub, which is the Fun House. Mm. And John Jellybean Benitez was the DJ at the time. And I was a teenager. I definitely was way too young to be in there, but my brother somehow got me in there, and I was hooked. You know, my world was changed at that very moment. And I was there every weekend religiously, and, you know, in front of the DJ booth, like, literally right there, just staring up at him, you know, as we see kids now, you know, like, inspired, you know.
Totally.
And that essentially is, you know, my intro into, you know, underground dance music.
Yeah.
So it started when I was a teenager.
What was it like, though, in the 80s in New York as a teenager growing up? Because I only know New York as today. I've been going to New York for 10 years, and obviously it's very different to what it was then. Right. What was it like being a kid raving?
Oh, man, it was magical. Yeah. It really was. You know, it was just, the venues were just everywhere, and, like, incredible venues I experienced. From the Fun House to... There was a venue called The Saint, which was a gay members-only nightclub that was on the east side of Manhattan. That was literally built to be a nightclub. When you have a moment, Google it, and you'll see some images. It was just a magical room. Mm. There was that. There was, you know, obviously the original Sound Factory, the Tunnel, Limelight, Palladium. There's just all these venues, so you can literally in one weekend, one night, just hop around to all these different massive mega clubs that were all packed. And that was just such an inspiring time, for me musically, because, you know, I'd sleep, I'd wake up at 3-4 a.m. and go out, you know, at that hour. That was the time to go out, you know, and I'd be out until, you know, the next morning. And sometimes we'd even go right to the record shops to try to find some of the tunes we were hearing, you know. or if we didn't go to the record shops, we'd go, you know, into my little, you know, cubby, and, you know, and like, I had this little drum machine and keyboard and just be all inspired to make something, you know.
Yeah.
So it was a really inspiring time musically, and the scene was just thriving with venues. That's special.
Yeah, I can imagine it's because it's very different to how it is today, right?
It's great in its own way,
totally.
But it's very different. You know, it wasn't so much the attention forward on the DJ. It was really you were paying attention to, you were focusing on the DJ through what was coming through the speakers, you know. That's and people were just dancing, you know, not facing you know, the DJ.
Was it more so back then that producers were producers and DJs were DJs, or was it a bit of both?
A bit of both, because a lot of the music that was coming out of New York were, you know, club kids like myself that were literally on the dance floor, you know, getting inspired, you know, through whoever we were listening to at that moment. So there was New York was thriving then.
Yeah,
the record labels, you know, there was tunes coming out of New York. You know, it was on the map in a big way. So it was a bit of both.
Yeah. When was your first show, or where was it? Like your first show where you're like, I'm playing, this is it.
Oh, well, you know, we would have to go back, because through DJing, through getting into DJing, I eventually started to buy a couple of pieces of gear and become very interested in producing, you know, and making music. And I'll never forget this. And you'll like this. My cousin, Anthony, Avision, his dad at the time was in a band, and he had his own recording studio. Mm. And I'll never forget the first time I walked into his studio and seeing all this gear and just being like, oh, okay, this is what I need to do. This is what I want to do.
Yeah. I love that. It's the best.
So I was inspired by his dad, you know, to start, you know, creating my own room and building my own studio. And I remember he had this Roland S550 sampler at the time. Classic. And it was like Roland's first sampler.
Yeah.
Keyboard. And, you know, and I was just blown away by how you could literally, you know, take a piece of vinyl, sample it in and play it across the keys. And I went out and bought it immediately and just literally like learned that thing inside and out. And from that moment, I was just like, okay, I love this. I want to know more, and just dove deep into it. And now we're approaching the early 90s. And I had a very close friend. His name is Gene LaFosse. He was also another neighborhood guy, DJ, really talented. And, we were always like hanging, you know, talking about music, and we just started working together and like informed this this group. It was called Program 2.
Okay.
And we and it was at the time in the early 90s where techno was really making its way into New York in a really big way.
Yeah.
Limelight was all techno. A lot of the venues were playing techno. And we got into that scene, but I'm talking about techno. We were doing like 145 beats per minute.
Proper really, techno.
Yeah, it was, you know, breakbeat techno. Yeah. You know, and we were creating all this very underground techno. And at the time, there was Frankie Bones, Joey Beltram, Damon Wild. I mean, there's a lot of guys in New York that were producing really proper techno. And we collaborated with Joey on a few tracks that really put us on the map. One of them was The Omen. It was called The Omen.
Okay.
Yeah. And that's when things really started to formulate and started to like, okay, like this something's happening here. Yeah. You know, my name got out there, and I started getting offered, you know, just some really small random gigs and warehouses and stuff, you know. And it's funny because once I got into producing, you know, like DJing sort of took a back seat at that time. You know, I was really focusing on creating music.
Yeah.
But then I started getting offered these gigs, and I was like, okay, let's do this. So I think my first like underground gig was in Toronto.
Okay.
I don't even remember the name.
What was the Toronto used to have like a really big club years ago?
Government.
The Government, that's it.
Yeah.
Did you ever play there?
Yeah, numerous times.
What was it like? Because I heard so many amazing stories, and it shut down the year I started touring.
Wow. Yeah, it was a special room because it was the first Phazon sound system outside the US, the Phazon was, you know, really popular sound system because of the Sound Factory, original Sound Factory in New York. They had this massive stack system in there, and it sounded incredible. Great room. Yeah. It's a shame you didn't get a chance to see
it. I would have loved to have done that. So you started out in New York and then pretty quickly kind of went to more international, or was it just US based?
I had some, international, mostly US based.
Yeah.
I mean, in my career, you know, for a good part of my career was, you know, pretty much based in the US.
Yeah.
That's where I think I thrived for whatever reason. Yeah.
It's really interesting, isn't it, how people can have like careers in certain markets and only stay in, for me, like the US is like my key market.
Right.
And I do most of my touring in the US. But it's really interesting in especially nowadays where we live in such a small world.
Yeah.
And with the internet, it is amazing that you still have like people that just tour in certain places.
It's surprising, you know, when, you know, I first started going, it was random, so random to me, to Bulgaria, like years ago. And they brought me out there because at the time, you know, I started working with a lot of commercial artists like Madonna and Sting and all that. Yeah. And you know, so they flew me out there. I didn't even know what Bulgaria was at the time. I was like, Bulgaria? I have fans there. But yeah, they knew me because of all of these, you know, remixes. Pop remixes that I was doing. I developed a really big following out there. And to this day, I play one of my favorite events throughout the year there in Bulgaria.
Let's talk about the 90s and remix culture. Because it's so different to how it is now. And how much influence house and techno had on the charts. Because in the UK, house music still has a huge influence in chart music still. But it's not how it's not how it used to be at all. What was it like doing remixes and sometimes the remixes being bigger than the actual original?
I mean, it was a great time. Especially for my career was just thriving at that time because all of the major labels were on board with the remixes were such a integral part of a release, you know, as far as it was a big marketing tool for, you know, for some of these big artists like Madonna and Sting and Beyonce. So it was great to see that, to have that support, you know, and then also see, you know, even radio supporting it, which is just not happening, like you said, now. No. You know, it's a very different time. It was really inspiring to have, you know, that attention, you know, on music that was underground and only played underground.
Yeah.
So, for me, that was like a great moment. You know, I was cranking them out. I was literally doing, you know, a mix in 3 days, you know, because I was given these deadlines.
Yeah.
Now I take fucking 3 months.
Yeah. Was it good money back then as well?
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. Like, and that was a big part of the inspiration. But it was fun. Yeah, it was fun. You know, when you had artists that were really involved in the process, not all of them were.
Yeah.
But some of them were. And I always say, like, for me, the highlight of my career was when I worked with Sting.
Wow.
Because he was really interested in every step of the way of the process of the whole remix of his music.
Yeah.
And to the point where he called me up and he was like, Vic, I love what you did. But I was like, okay, well, he's like, I want to re-record the vocals because I had time stretched his vocals.
Okay.
But that was the best thing for me to hear. I was like, yes, let's do it. He's like, okay, just send me a location, studio time, and I'll be there.
No way. What was that like?
Incredible. Incredible moment to be sitting next to a man that I had like literally grown up listening to his music. The Police was, you know, it was on a whole nother level for me having him by my side behind a console saying, okay, and he showed up. He was just like, okay, if this was the Desert Rose remix that I did for him.
Okay.
He had shown up and he was just like, okay, this is your session. Tell me what you want, you know? And I was just like,
what the fuck?
Okay, I need to fucking deliver.
Oh man, that's special.
It was an amazing time. I booked the Hit Factory in New York City, which was an incredible room. And he went into the vocal booth and just literally, like, from start to finish, nailed it. Like,
really?
One take.
No way.
I wanted to be able to say, oh, can we go in there and, like, you know, redo that? But I was just like, I just fucking nailed it. I can't even critique it, you know? I was like, okay, like, let's maybe add some ad-libs, you know? Let's, like, I was just blown away of, like, how spot on his voice was and how, like, how he was just able to deliver that effortlessly, you know?
They were true artists, weren't they? Then I think the difference now is, like what you said, is that then sometimes the artists were involved in it. Now it's just a A&R of a label that's asking you to do it, and half the time the original artists don't even hear the remixes. Yeah. It's not.
Yeah, I mean, there are many moments like that. I did quite a few remixes for Beyonce, but yeah. It was never involved. Yeah. I only dealt with the record label or her managers.
Mm. It's a bit sad when I find it. It's a bit sad when it's like that, because I think that's when it turns into a business, right? And obviously we're gonna do it because we're getting paid pretty good money to do something that we wouldn't usually get paid that much money to do. Like, usually if we're doing a remix, we're doing it for a mate and we're not getting paid for it.
Whereas there's some creative excitement, you know, that is driving you.
Yeah, because I remember I did a Rihanna remix, and it was like, I did like a Rihanna and U2, and they were both different experiences. But the Rihanna one, I was just like, I just know that she's just not going to ever hear this. And like, it's kind of like, although it's great to say that I've done one, but it's like, it doesn't really.
That's when you just take it and like flip it on its fucking side and make it your own.
Exactly.
You know? Or send her a version that would make them happy and then, you know, make your own thing out of it.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
You know, it's interesting, you know, that we're talking about this, because when I was working with Madonna, she really pushed me,
love that.
To the point where I would deliver a mix and she would call me and say, it's good, but I didn't think, and I'm feeling so good about it. Like, oh, fuck, this is solid, you know, like, she's going to love this. And she would call me, she's like, I think you could change this. I was like, really? And, you know, like, not to her, but I was saying to myself, oh, I don't necessarily agree with what she's saying. Mm. But then once I went back in there and made those changes, it just elevated the mix to, and took it somewhere else that I hadn't originally thought about. So yeah, there's that creative flow that, you know, if the artist is not involved, that you would just like literally, you know, miss out on.
I think also with Madonna as well, correct me if I'm wrong, but her music, especially those days, was very much dance floor focused. It was like proper disco club records to a certain extent. Yeah. And if you would want to play those records in your sets if you had a version for yourself, right?
Because
you know it's going to have a reaction that no one else has this remix before you have it. Like, people know the original record, and it's a special moment when you've got something like that. And it makes sense for her to want them to be big. I'm pretty sure, like, some of her records got big because of the clubs.
Oh, for sure. Yes, absolutely. I mean, there were elements there that really already lent themselves. As you said, you know, they're dance records, you know, from the start. I would receive all these stems, and there was just so much that I was like excited about. Okay, yeah, I can take this and I can use this and use this. The dance mix still would also just take it, you know, somewhere else where, you know, she was still focused on radio, but like, we would take it on the ground and, you know, make it playable for DJs and my own sets.
Yeah, totally.
So it was exciting to have that, you know, like a new Madonna remix that was not out. I was testing everything at the time, because when I was working with Madonna, I had my residency at the Roxy in New York City.
Okay.
And it was a gay Saturday night. And that's when New York was just really so special, because to hear good underground dance music, you had to go into the gay venues, you know, and as a straight man, you know, it was just like, this was a whole another world for me. And then, you know, like blowing up as a DJ in that world, it was just it's just like mind-boggling, you know. It's a weird dynamic, you know.
When did that stop though? Because like I've never experienced that part of the scene. I've experienced gay clubs, but I've never experienced the scene being a gay driven scene. And obviously I know where it came from, but when did it stop for like, right, especially in New York, and Chicago and all of that, when did that kind of end and it just kind of turn into,
I think around the Giuliani era, you know, that era of when, you know, the city was, you know, on a mission to shut down all the venues.
Yeah.
I think that had a really negative impact on the scene.
Yeah.
And in a sense, just like, you know, did away with all these really great underground rooms. And it continued a little bit, but I think at around then or just before then is when it really started to end.
Yeah.
It's like it's in the 2000, early 2000s, yeah, or something. Yeah, it was a really inspiring time, you know, like, have, you know, you to be able to play techno for these gay audiences.
Yeah.
It wasn't just about vocals, you know. It was everything across the board. Yeah.
Yeah, it's the one thing that I've always wanted to do is play in more gay clubs. But for me, like growing up without going to gay clubs, because the only gay clubs in like my local cities are just like really commercial, cheesy clubs.
Yeah.
And it's almost like there's almost nothing for the cool gay people out there, right, and for the people that want to listen to like forward pushing music. And it's kind of sad to me. I don't understand why it's kind of gone that way.
I don't know what happened there. Yeah. I mean, the best audience is a diverse audience, you know?
Exactly.
It was just life, you know, and everyone was just there for music and, you know, there was no judgment. It was just acceptance and it was beautiful. It was just really beautiful. I mean, look at Bergheim and Panorama Bar, you know, they're still doing it. They're still experiencing that.
Yeah. You know? I had, do you know Sophia Kearney and Stephen Brains? They run a night called He She They.
Oh, I don't know it.
You should check it out. It's they're based in the UK, but they tour the event around the world. And there, Stephen's a gay guy. I believe Sophia's straight. But they also manage, they also own the Weird and Wonderful management company, which they manage, okay, like Maya Jane Coles and people like that.
I've heard of the company.
So they do this party, which is like all in, like it's really all inclusive. So it's kind of bringing back that kind of gay, bi kind of scene.
There's pockets of it. I mean, even in Brooklyn, you know, there are a lot of, you know, underground parties that are happening, you know, now there's Hunter and, you know, there's a few that are happening they're doing it.
I just wish it was just a bigger thing, if I'm honest.
Yeah, I agree. For me, it's the best audience to play for. You know, when it's just open like that, you play with such a sense of freedom, and you know, you don't question anything that you're playing because they're there for the journey, you know.
I want to talk about residencies, because there was like 90s, early 2000s, residencies were like a thing. And then I feel like they've kind of fizzled out now and it's not a thing at all. What can you explain to people that didn't kind of understand what residencies were, what they were about, and kind of how much it can actually change someone's career?
Well, absolutely. For me, my first big residency, it actually started in Miami, at a night called Liquid.
Okay.
And that was owned by Chris Pacello and Ingrid Caceres. And at the time, I'm going to pedal back a minute. I had gone through a hiatus in music. I had taken a break. The whole program thing, program two thing sort of you know, we split and we stopped working together, and I wasn't even in the studio at all. I wasn't DJing. I mean, it's kind of a long story, but I randomly got into the restaurant business.
Okay.
I'm talking about in like 95.
Okay.
It's at the time is when I met my wife.
Yeah.
So, hadn't been working in music at that point. And I wasn't sure what was going to be my path. I was kind of really depressed about it. Like, wow. You know, I thought like this was going to, you know, be my future, my career.
Yeah.
And, so I'm in this restaurant, you know, I became the person that was literally opening and closing this restaurant.
Yeah.
You know, my partner's with a friend, and that's how I got involved in it. But I wasn't doing anything in music, and I met my wife, and she would come to the restaurant. We would sit in this booth in the corner, and she would always say to me, Vic, you're always talking about music. You know, you're always like, you're constantly bringing up music.
Yeah.
You're constantly bringing up, you know, production and, you know, DJing. And she's like, you're not happy here. She's like, you know, like, go back to doing what you were doing, you know, like, give it another shot. And it really struck with me. And I was just like, you know, you're right.
Yeah.
I'm going to give it one last shot. And I sold my share in the restaurant, went back into the studio. I'll never forget the night I sold my share. I was supposed to have dinner with her, and we were just not even dating at the time. We were just friends.
Yeah.
And I was like, you know what, babe? I was like, I've been walking past my studio for a couple of years, watching it collect dust. I'm going to go back in there and try to do something. And I produced this track, not knowingly. It was called Give It Up.
Okay.
And it came out on 8-Ball Records.
Mm-hmm.
And
to my surprise, it's a great record.
Thank you. To my surprise, the record literally just
blew up,
took off, and I had no idea at the time. I really had no idea. I'll never forget. I went to a music conference in Miami. I was like, okay, I need to get back into things and see what's going on in the industry, and hear DJs and hear music. And so I went to a music conference just before the release came out. Every venue, it was just so weird. Every venue I walked into, my record was playing, and I was just like, whoa, what the fuck is going on? Through that, the reason why I get into the story, through that is how I landed my first residency in Miami at Liquid. Because the track at the time when Billboard was charting underground tracks, it was number one at the Billboard charts.
Wow.
And the venue owner at the time saw that, and he was like, let's get this guy in here, you know? It was just random like that.
Yeah.
And I'll never forget. And it was a gay Sunday night that they brought me out there to play. And it was just an explosive night.
Yeah.
And I remember just like, I was from that moment on, I was on the map. And everyone thought I was a Miami local. Everyone thought I was from Miami. But meanwhile, I was, that night, like, the owner was just like, okay, I'm flying you out here weekly. I'm going to get you a place, you know, like, tell me whatever it takes. I want you here every week. And he offered this residency.
Okay. Amazing.
The thing that makes, what's that?
Amazing.
Yeah. It was just like, what is happening? You know, I went from sitting in this restaurant miserable to like having, you know, launched this career like unknowingly, you know, it just like all sort of just started like snowballing.
Yeah.
It's just so weird that the way it was happening so fast. And I was like, yeah, man, I'm ready. Like, yeah. You know, I didn't move to Miami, but I was literally flying there every weekend to play this gay Sunday night.
And how long were you playing for? Were you all night long?
All night long.
Yeah.
Start to finish.
Yeah.
Literally doors open to, you know, doors closed. And back then,
it was long. That's a long shift.
Yeah, it was long nights, you know. I'd be there at 11 p.m. and, you know, I was out of there at 11 a.m.
Yeah.
Yeah. So... it was just an exciting time. And the special thing about a residency is your audience really gets to know you and you really get to know them well. Yeah. And you start to tease them throughout the night when you're playing these long sets and, you know, they're just waiting for you to drop that record, you know, that you played last week. They're hanging on, you know, that moment, you know, and that is the special thing about, like, you know, really coming together in that way, you know, weekly, you know, like you really, you just get to experience this journey in a very different way. Where, you know, it's, you're like, because back then music wasn't so accessible, you know, so, and certain DJs had certain vinyls and others didn't. And like, you know, so like they were showing up every week, you know, waiting for you to, you know, to play those tracks. And yeah, it was just a magical time, you know, like growing it in that way.
Yeah, I think also it's very different nowadays, and I'm not saying it's worse or better. It's just very different.
Right.
Do you think the residency culture could come back?
I don't know. You know, I think that quite often, and even for myself, because I am that type of DJ.
Yeah.
I am that type of DJ. I prefer the long sets. I prefer the journey. I prefer to be able to build my set. You know, I mean, playing a 2-hour set or, you know, hour and a half set has never been something that I'm crazy about. I do it, you know, you could have a good set. It could be, you know, impactful. It could, you know, be a great moment at a festival. But you don't really get to tell a story, you know, in that amount of time, you know. And even as a DJ, you know, like really settle in and, you know, find your bearings, get used to the DJ booth and, you know, like really settle in, you know?
Yeah. I feel
Yeah. For me, you know, I've always preferred the residency style. Maybe it's possible. I don't know. I think everything is just so fragmented right now. There's so many more DJs, a lot of talent out there. So venues, you know, you can't blame them for wanting to, you know, bring a lot of this talent through their venue. And I think, you know, the audience has just become accustomed to that lately. And the idea of one guy, you know, playing every week, you know,
doesn't cut it, does it? It doesn't cut it.
Like, you know, these kids are like, wait a minute, where's the lineup? Where the fuck is the lineup? Really? You're playing all night, you know?
Yeah, and charging you the same amount of money. Because back when residencies were big and it was like less about the DJ and more about just the club night, how much did it cost to get into a club in around those times?
I mean, in the 90s, it was probably $20, you know, to enter into the room. I mean, it got way more expensive as time went on. But yeah, I mean, to have a, you know, 12-hour night, you know, that's all you had to pay.
It's a
know,
cheap night, isn't it? Where now,
it's a really cheap night.
Where if you can get a $20 ticket for a big lineup, it's like, how much is a Brooklyn Mirage ticket going for? Something like nowadays, it's like insane amounts of money.
Yeah, it's a very expensive night.
Yeah. And then it's not just, it's drinks on top of that. It's everything. It's a very different industry now. I want to know about your New York residencies.
So interesting that, you know, we just went into that whole Miami thing. So even everyone from New York, because at the time I wasn't doing anything in New York, thought I was a Miami local. So I'll never forget, at the time the Palladium was open in New York City. Insane room as well.
Yeah.
Like another magical mega club in New York City. And my wife was a bartender at the Palladium. And I remember being at the bar just chatting with her and all of these people like coming up to me, like, you know, and again, it was a gay Saturday night and Junior Vasquez was a DJ
amazing
at the Palladium at the time.
Yeah.
And I remember like all these queens coming up to me like, my God, I just heard you in Miami. Like, you just blew me away. Well, what's your story? Where are you from? Like literally, like all these people coming up to me. I was like, I'm from New York, you know, yeah. Like I'm a New York guy and from Brooklyn. And I just remember like all this like hype about me, you know, but this Miami DJ. But meanwhile, I was from New York, but I had nothing going on in New York. And that's when these two gay promoters at the time, Mark Berkeley and John Blair, they had a big gay Saturday night, which they were also doing the juniors party at the Palladium, were launching the Roxy. They were planning to open up the Roxy. And they, through all this hype, you know, offered me the residency for the opening, the reopening. The Roxy had been around for years, but it had closed. And so they were launching a new gay Saturday night there. Mm. And they offered me this residency. And I was like, wow, what is happening, man? This is just crazy. So that's how I started my first New York night was with the Roxy and with those guys. And it was just a massive Saturday night, 4,000 boys, you know. The Roxy was an old roller rink, so it was this room. And again, the weekly, it was a weekly night. So I was playing New York.
And then Miami.
It was just crazy.
Wow. It's kind of weird because the residency thing just doesn't happen now. And I know I sound like a broken record, but I'm just like, I couldn't imagine what it would be like. Because if the Roxy was that big, like that is pretty much like playing at Brooklyn Mirage every weekend.
Every weekend, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I guess it was happening recently in Ibiza, you know, with Marco and Amnesia. And like, you know, the residency thing works there.
Yeah. I think the different thing is in Ibiza is that every week you have new people. It's not the same people that go. So it's not the club culture. When I used to live in Ibiza, every Wednesday and Saturday was changeover day. So you just know that every Wednesday and Saturday you'd get 10,000-20,000 more people coming in and doing it. What was your first Ibiza show?
Oh, wow.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. JD Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
I think it was Amnesia.
Yeah.
But it was a manumission night.
Yeah. Okay, so you were at the manumission at Amnesia.
Yes.
Interesting.
And the DJ booth was just over the pool.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, it was such a...
Oh, no, setup. that was privilege.
No, that was privilege. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Right. It was privilege. Yes. Not Amnesia.
Yeah.
It was a privilege. That was my first
time.
Entry into Ibiza. Yeah.
That was a special night on the island. That was like the night on the island back in the day.
Yeah.
I remember
like before going there to play and checking out the night, and I was like, wow, this is crazy. Mm. Yeah.
Yeah, man. Yeah, yeah, I bet. So this is the one thing I want to know, without being too nosy, into your like personal life and everything like that. But the longevity of your career is unbelievable. And there's not many people in this scene that has been around for how long you have been around for and is still very consistent. What's the kind of key to that? How did that happen?
Oh, thank you for that compliment. I've always tried to be very aware and dialed into that, like of not becoming stagnant and,
yeah,
you know, just trying to evolve in some way. And yeah. I remember there were moments going back to playing, you know, these really big gay circuit parties. Mm. You know, I developed this really big gay following, and I was playing a lot of circuit parties. In the end, it went from underground New York gay scene to becoming, it started transitioning into these like circuit parties, like, yeah, they're like sort of gay festivals, you, yeah, know. And I remember getting to the point where musically I felt trapped. Mm. I'd go shop for music and I'd buy all this really amazing techno and tribal and underground music, and then I would go to play and I felt like it was not,
yeah,
working for me. So I remember when I left the Roxy, I literally left the residency. Mm. At one point I was just like, okay, I think it's time to change it up.
Yeah,
I just went through those moments personally where I felt like I'm either gonna, like, you know, just be this jukebox and play for this audience, mm, and kill my career, or I make a change,
yeah,
and, you know, and break into something else where I'm inspired again to play. Yeah. Which was really hard for me to do, because any of the straight promoters that were putting on any events had this perception of me of being, oh yeah, Victor Calderon, you know, he's a gay DJ, yeah, you know, yeah, like, he's a circuit DJ. So it was really hard for me to break down that, you know, that perception and be like, I can play for your audience, yeah, you know, I can get dirty and play some techno that I know, you know, that will light up your floor, but yeah, they weren't giving me the opportunity, you know, because they had this idea of me of like playing, you know, vocals and Madonna, and like, so it was challenging to like say, okay, you know, I'm not going to do that anymore. Right. I'm going to play music I really want to play. And so I went through quite a few of those moments where, like, you know, reincarnations of my career, you know, where I think it's really important to, like, you know, get to those points and look at what you're doing and say, okay, am I happy? Like, you know, like,
yeah,
I can, yeah, continue with this and, you know, make that paycheck. And, but is it going to take me to the next point of my career? Like, so I was always very aware of that, like, and trying to like evolve.
Yeah.
And hence why I started a night called Evolve, you know.
Okay.
In New York at the time, Crowbar was opening.
Yeah.
Which was another, like, it was like the first return of a mega club.
Yeah,
after,
yeah,
Ladium had closed down, Sound Factory had closed down.
What year was this?
2006 or seven, around, okay, there, I believe. Yeah. Yeah. And I was at that point of changing everything, mm, you know, like musically. I knew I was going to lose a lot of people, but I knew I was going to gain, you know, a new audience, yeah, as well. So as risky as it was, you know, I was ready to do it. I knew I needed to do it,
yeah,
you know, in order to, like, you know, move to the next thing in my career.
Mm.
So I launched this night called Evolve. I put out an album around it, you know, like this new sound, whatever, you know.
Yeah.
A bit more, I was introduced, because I was, at the time when I was playing a lot of the gay venues, it was all tribal. I was, yeah, playing all this tribal, you know.
New York was huge for tribal as well.
Yeah.
There was a period, yeah, where New York was, like, all about tribal.
Yeah. And I became known for tribal. And so now I was like, okay, I was digging through my collection. I was playing, I was finding all this really amazing techno, you know, that I was just literally slowing down. And I was infusing it into my sets more and more and more and more, you know. And we, this night just took off. I was like, you know, with working with the promoters, of course, I was like, let's do this. Let's go back. Let's charge $20 to get in. Cause just before that, the prices were getting really crazy to get into the venue, $100, you know, $150. Yeah. I was like, let's go back. I want to start at 5 a.m. Let's charge $20 to get in the door. Open door, like let everyone in. Like I want to try to get that diverse crowd back in here again. Like that was the whole concept of the night. You know, we're evolving. And this night just became massive for me, and I relaunched my career. You know, it gave me life musically. Like it just started a whole nother like a decade for me. You know, of being able to, you know. Have something to say musically.
Were you booking other artists for that as well, or was it just you?
It was just me.
Nice.
I would have like local guys, you know, just play just before me. Like they would play the slot up until 4 a.m., 4:30 a.m., and then I would go on at around 5 a.m., and I would play until 5 in the afternoon. So it was always a 12-hour, maybe sometimes more.
On Sundays?
Yes.
Yeah.
It was Saturdays into Sundays. So, and it was a really incredible, diverse, all-inclusive audience. And again, it was magic. The room lent itself for these dramatic installations we would do. You know, I would bring in lighting rigs. I would just try to always think like, okay, let's do something really special, you know. So it was that kind of energy and excitement. You know, around the night, and it just really took off, and it became a really big night for me in New York. And then also, like, I think started to change that perception for me in some territories, you know, as far as me breaking into playing for some of these straight venues and events. So going back to what you were saying, it's like, I always would come to those moments of like, okay, I need to change it up. I need to do something here that is going to get me, you know, to the next point of my career and, you know, have some longevity.
It's always super important to keep your, I kind of sometimes look at it as keeping yourself happy. And sometimes you got to do the most weird things that everyone from the outside is like, what the fuck is he doing?
Right.
But it makes so much more sense in your head, and it takes time for you to kind of communicate that to other people. But once it's communicated, it makes sense to everybody. And as long as the story's told correctly, it's 100% the best thing you could possibly do.
Absolutely. If you really believe in what, you know, you're doing and you stand behind it, it'll be so rewarding you know, to you in the end, because it will pay off. You know, if you know you have something really strong to say, people will listen, and musically that they'll be all ears and follow you.
Yeah, totally, man. Do you think you could do that again in New York? Do you think the times have changed too much?
No, I think it's possible. Okay. I think it's possible. And I'm always like, you know, my radar is always spinning, like, okay, what's happening here? What room is opening? What, you know, like, you know, hear about like, you know, new rooms or, you know, and then it has to be right. But, you know, there are so many layers, there are so many components, that I think need to be in place in order for that to happen again. And a lot of the rooms that have been opening recently sort of missed the mark. You know, they're built for the wrong reason. You know, they're not built in that way. I have this reference, you know, for me, the best room in New York City was the original Sound Factory.
Okay.
I mean, there are other really magical rooms, but sonically, this room was just perfection, you know, and you heard music the way it was meant to be heard.
Yeah.
And, you know, and it wasn't over the top. It wasn't this like sensory overload. Yes, they had a really cool lighting rig, but you just were there and you could not help but to be drawn in and lose yourself in the music, you know? So for me, that's my reference, you know, like, and I think these kids that are experiencing the festival culture can enjoy that. No. You know, they can walk into the room in the same way I did and be like, whoa, what the fuck is this? This is something else.
Yeah.
This is something I have not experienced, you know. But like I said, it needs to have everything in line, you know, and aligned, you know, in order for that to happen, you know. Like the room needs to be built with that intention, you know. So
would you ever open your own?
I've considered it so many times. I somehow talk myself out of it, you know, like there's a lot of baggage that comes with nightclubs, unfortunately, you know, and but I feel like there's this part of me that like wants to say something in that way, and maybe that maybe that would be my last
last hurrah.
You know, like, build your fucking room, you know, launch a new residency, and you know, just and just create a new magical moment. But it's easier said than done.
It's so much easier said than done. It's so much. It's so expensive. To
it's impossible to do that now, you know, in New York, especially in the city. And the big reason why a lot of the venues moved into the boroughs like Brooklyn was because it was just financially just did not make sense. It was impossible to survive, you know, the rents and the costs of doing that. You know, you couldn't take a risk, you know, spending, you know, $20 million to build a room. Just there's no way you ever recoup that.
No, never. That's not what it's about. That's not how it started. It wasn't.
No.
Clubs were never built to be made as huge money makers. Although we all know they make a shit ton of money.
Right.
But if done badly, they can, or even not if they're done badly. If it's just not, if the business doesn't align, there's a lot of money to be lost as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And yeah, that's why, you know, the rooms are built with a different intention now. I walk into some rooms and I could like, it's a weird thing like that I have. I'm just like, oh man, that light is too bright. That the sound needs to be this. I just like, you know, critique it as I'm walking in to go and play. And I'm like, oh God, you know, and I'm like literally talking to the light guy. I'm talking to this guy, like, you know, turn, you know, shut that door. There's a bright light coming in from there, you know, like put a curtain over it, you know, like just, there are all these things that, you know, are intrusive into the experience that, and, you know, in order to have that, you know, like immersive, lose yourself type of room, those things need to be right. Starting with sound system, you know, like that's such an important, integral part. You got a fucking dope sound system, you have a party, you know,
totally.
You have a party because the music is being heard as it should be heard.
Yeah. No, I totally agree with that. And I think it gets lost more and more because clubs become more and more commercialized and it's more about making money. So it's businessmen opening clubs rather than DJs and producers or sound system freaks and things like that.
Whenever a DJ has opened a room, I mean, you can tell, you know, going back to Nicholas Matar with, you know, with Cielo and with Output, it's like, okay, you know, like he knows what it takes, you know, to deliver that experience.
I never went to Cielo and I always like get annoyed with myself for not going because I had the opportunity to go multiple times and just never went.
Cool room, very cool room. Yeah.
But Output was something else. I remember I played the Panther Room, which is personally my favorite room in the venue.
Yeah,
but that club was special as well.
Yeah,
it was special. What's your favorite room to play in America now or in the world?
It was Stereo Montreal.
Yeah,
you know, before the pandemic, that room, I think, was a blueprint of the original Sound Factory, originally built from Angel Morris. And, you know, he was a Brooklyn boy like myself, you know, inspired by, you know, early New York Sound Factory and Sound System. And he literally built the Sound Factory in Montreal, you know. And he created the magic that we had here in New York, there, you know, that room. If you know what Stereo is about and know how to play that room, it becomes your favorite room. You know, it's just, the audience is magical. There's still magic in that room to this day. Obviously it's been closed for 2 years, but even my last gig, which was literally the week before everything shut down. And I was like, wow, what a weird way to go into this pandemic, like playing Stereo as my last gig and having that, like, you know, memory. But I always say Stereo changed me as a DJ. You know, like, just that, having that sound system is such a tool, you know, and it becomes such a part of what you're doing. And you're not just playing a track, you're fucking playing a track. You know, you're really, you know, accenting, and, you know, like, you want to get a rise out of the audience. When the audience knows what the room is about, you could easily get a rise out of them, you know, playing with the sound system. And it's just, it just really opened up playing music in a very different way for me. And, you know, and then after playing in a room like that and then going to a really crappy room, you're just like, you feel like, what, my hands are tied behind my back. You know, none of these fucking records sound the way they're supposed to. You start, like, looking through your collection and be like, oh, I can't play this because they're not going to sound right. So it changes you as a, you know, it changes your set that night. It changes you as a DJ. You know, you don't end up playing the way you should play. Now, I have no fucking more patience for clubs with bad sound systems. I just don't. I just, it's like, what's the point? You know, like, why are we all here? You know, we're here to lose ourselves, and, like, you know, sound is just awful. You know,
there's so many of them well.
I sound like a snob, but
no. But the thing is people forget that we're in the music business, right? And we're in the music industry, and we're in the business because we're lucky enough that we earn money from it, but we're in it because we absolutely love music. And if you're not in it for that, then it's not your life. It eventually fizzles out, and you'll eventually be doing something else. But if you actually love the music, you want to hear everything you play or everything you make to the highest quality, and you want everyone else to experience it to the highest of quality.
Exactly.
And there's nothing better than going to a venue and the sound and the lighting guy, girl, whoever it is like really passionate about how it sounds. And like just the tech, like turning up to a club and the tech being all correct and people, the crew knowing who you are and what you're about to play. And if they don't know who you are, then afterwards they know who you are and they will come up to you because they're working in the industry because they love the music. They're not working in the industry to make a shit ton of money. They're in it to enjoy it, if you know what I mean.
They're creatively, you know, adding their layer into what you're doing.
Totally. And that goes down to the security guards. Like my goal in pretty much every set is to make sure that the security guards have the best time. And it's kind of sounds a bit stupid, but it's like
it matters.
The security guards, the bar staff, like everyone that's working the club has to have a nice time. And yeah. if you're the one DJ that comes in and makes sure that they have the best time, you can guarantee that everybody that's paid to see you is having the best time. And no one wants to be in a club and hate it for 12 hours. And
but you just mentioned something that is really super important. The moment they're walking through that entrance, you know, what that experience was for them could have, you know, an impact on how they feel once they get into the room.
Yeah.
If they were just raped by some security guard, you know, searching them for whatever reason, and there was some bad energy thrown at them through some, you know, security guard that was just, you know, on steroids, it just changes their experience. Totally. You know, like they're just like, they're never going to get out of that head and be in the room and be like, oh man, you know, like this fucking place sucks.
Yeah. There's something about, I think that's the thing. If I had my own club, which I've nearly done before. I talked to myself.
Really?
In Bristol, I quit music. I quit producing and DJing for like 6 months, and I had a venue and we were about to open it. It was about to kind of go. And then the landlord asked for an extra like 20,000 a year, which at that time was a lot, for what they were asking. And we were like, this is just, doesn't feel right when we're like a month out from opening and now they're changing it. I was like, there's something telling me not to do this. So we didn't do it. But for me, the key thing is creating an environment that everyone, when everyone goes there, they're having the best possible time from start to finish. Whether they've had to wait at the front for half an hour to get in, that half an hour of them waiting has been an enjoyable experience. And I think when clubs do that, and there's not many clubs that do that nowadays, from what I experience, but when they do, you really feel the difference.
Yeah. It's very important. Not easy to do.
It's really not. It's really not, especially when you're dealing with the general public as well.
Yeah.
The general public, they're hard cookies to kind of please, if you know what I mean, especially when they're spending good money to go and see you. They want everything straight away. Did you ever like do anything outside of music during, did you like do any other businesses or do anything like that?
No, I can't say that I have. I mean, my wife and I over the years, we've always been very much involved in the real estate market. And I feel like that was always like a side thing for me, but still something that I was enjoying. Yeah. My wife's an interior designer.
Amazing.
Excuse me. And she became an interior designer through all of the homes that we were like buying and building for ourselves.
Yeah.
And it's sort of, unknowingly became this business for us, you know, like, but it was more at a personal need. Like, you know, we bought our first apartment. It was like a one bedroom. Then we wanted a two bedroom. Then we wanted a two bedroom with a view.
Yeah.
And we were on this, I call us serial movers. We were on this like crazy cycle of every 2-3 years, you know, selling and buying a new place.
Yeah.
And, through that, you know, we were just like, oh wow, we're pretty good at this. So I had a personal need, you know, we were building these incredible homes and it was exciting. And that was something I really enjoyed. Huge fucking distraction, you know? And I got to the point where, I was just like, whoa, okay, this is not good for me. It's not good for my career. Over the last, couple, projects that we did. One was this townhouse that I'm in now, massive renovation, and it almost killed me. It was just like just way bigger than I had expected, and really pulled me out of, you know, all my creative things that I was doing. I just couldn't focus on anything else because it just demanded that sort of attention. And I was like, okay, whoa, that's it. I'm not doing this anymore.
Yeah.
I need to like refocus my energy back in the studio. And over the last couple of years, obviously for reasons we all know, you know, it's been a little bit of a, you know, not a little bit of a distraction. It's been a major distraction. Trying to get back in there and you know, because you know yourself, like the magic doesn't happen and unless you're in there consistently, you know, until you find your way, until you nail that, like, that groove that, like, I know I can, structure this and finish this track, you know. So that takes, you know, being in there on a consistent, you know, level.
Yeah, it takes time.
I wasn't doing that. I was so pulled away from it all. So I said to my wife, okay, babe.
You're on your own.
You do it. Have fun. but I'm going back to work.
But I also think sometimes having something to take you out of it can be really important to kind of bring you back in. For me, like during COVID, I wrote a shit ton. And then in the last 6 months, I guess 4 months, no, most of this year, to be fair, I haven't written hardly anything.
Right. And yeah, we have those moments, you know.
Yeah, it's the first time in my career that I've not been writing every single day of my life for
Also been really doing your thing, touring. I mean, I you know, I've noticed in a way, like your career is at such a really like great level at this point. You know?
Thank
so
you, man.
I guess what you did during the pandemic really.
Really helped.
Paid off. It's okay, you know. Yeah. Enjoy this moment. You know, you're going to be inspired, and you know, find that time again for yourself.
Yeah, for me, I don't know about you, but for me, it's that. It's also, I'm not. It would be interesting to see your thoughts on what music is coming out at this moment in time. But for me, it's like I'm trying to write stuff when I do go and write. I'm trying to write stuff that. Is, and it sounds very cliche, but it's something that's gonna last a long time, and it's not what I feel a lot of the industry is at this moment in time, where you release your record and 2 weeks later it's forgotten about. And it's not necessarily forgotten about by our peers or in clubs, but streaming, record sales, it's kind of record labels, it's like onto the next record. Rather than
it's just so much of it coming out that it's on to the next thing. It's sort of become so disposable in a sense. You know?
Yeah,
no, but you're spot on about what you're saying, and that's we put this added pressure by thinking in that way. You know, like I want to come up with this tune that has longevity. Like, that's fucking a lot of pressure to put on yourself when you be creative. If you go in there with that intention, you know, it's just,
I think
I go in there and just, you know, load some cool synth and see where it goes, you know, it's a different approach.
Yeah. I've stopped doing that where I'm just like, I've stopped just going in and jamming, which is fine. Cause I sometimes get to the point where I'm like this, I can write a club record, if you know what I mean. I know that I can write a club record. I'm not worried about, like, I need to push myself. And I think having to push yourself and kind of being nervous to go in the studio helps me personally. Like, I get worried about going into the studio and kind of, like, just because I want to perform. And it's not like I'm trying to write hit records. It's not like I'm going into the studio and going, you must write a hit. We all know that's not good. But it's like, how can I go into the studio and do something different that is going to actually make people look at me as an artist, me as Will Clark as an artist differently? What kind of process are you kind of taking at this moment back? Now you're like... off the like interior designing and renovating, like you're back in the studio. What's the kind of vibe you're going for?
You know, it's interesting because throughout the pandemic, you know, I was writing music, some of it house, some of it techno, some of it electronic, you know, I was just all over the fucking place. Yeah. You know? And I have all these projects that some of them close to finish, some of them, you know, just ideas, I really didn't have any sort of process. I was just trying to like be in there in a consistent way. And that was my struggle, you know, but obviously the pandemic lent itself, but we were like held up at my summer home for the last 18 months and I don't have a recording studio there. So Yeah, which is kind of crazy to think, you know, that I've had the one home that we've never sold. We've had it for almost 12 years that I never built the fucking recording studio there, which now that we're talking about it, I'm in the process of building a room there as well. So I'll have my Brooklyn room and I'll have my a proper room there as well. But going back to what you were saying, just like I've been sort of like loading up, catching back up, you know, on all new plugins and software and synths, and just to like be able to turn something on and find inspiration and you know, something that I like randomly come across, you know, whether it be just a cool sound that leads me into a direction. That's sort of how I've been going in there, you know, like that's, it's worked for me in the past, and that's, I'm going to try that.
Just enjoy
it, man. Need to keep my butt in the studio. And that's been the challenge for me. Yeah. You know, and obviously, you know, I'm sure even for yourself, like touring, you know, it sort of, you know, it pulls you out in a sense. And then you have all of other life shit, you know, coming home, having a kid, you know, my wife. And I had fucking crazy year. You know, I caught COVID in February.
Yeah.
And cancer in May.
Yeah, that's not a lucky year, to be fair.
It was an extra fucking year.
is all the cancer good now?
I'm good. Yeah, good. I'm 100% good. We caught it super early. My doctors were amazing, and like, you know, they got me in there and got it out. I didn't have to go through any chemo. Radiation or amazing. Chemo. I got lucky. Yeah. I got really lucky.
It's a fucker, that, isn't it? It's a fucker.
And even now, talking about it, and when I think about it, and even saying, "Wow, I had cancer!" I never even imagined something like that. But I mean, that's life. That's the shit. You know, that I guess when you get to a certain age, or even not, that there's no age. No. That, you know, it doesn't matter. Just shit that happens.
Yeah. I think that's so the thing it's kind of that thing. Have you had things throughout your career? I guess getting married, having kids, like you have all these kind of life things that your career still has to kind of go around, and certain things become your priorities and things like that. How did you find like building a family whilst also doing the music industry? Because I've got friends that the minute they had a kid, either like was like, yeah, I'm not really into it anymore. And then I've had other friends that are like, no, it's actually helped them because they're like even more focused.
Yes. That's how I felt.
Yeah.
You know, having a family, it kept me grounded. And my wife was an integral part of my career all the way through, you know, but anytime I was, you know, thinking about making a change or, you know, really important decision for my career, you know, I had her there to like, you know, talk to, and which was, a big part of how I moved forward, having that family to come home to, because what we do is fucking crazy. It's insane. You know, it's like, you know, you're flying all over the world. You're not sleeping. You're not eating well. It's like your senses are just like so thrown off.
Yeah.
I felt like I needed that. I needed to come home to my family. It really helped me, you know, like just dial back into like, you know, a clear head.
Yeah.
There's a way to manage both. There certainly is. You know, there are many guys that are doing it, and it really, for me, it helped me for sure. Yeah. It was something that kept me focused.
Yeah, I can imagine it being very grounding to a certain extent as well, because for me, like, I don't have kids, I don't have a partner, but when I'm in the UK, which I am at the moment, I have like a place right next door to my parents, and like I get to see them and my brothers and sisters and stuff, but there's something about coming home, which is very grounding for me as well, where you can like, I live in a tiny village. Like you can walk down the street and guarantee, you know, somebody. And it's like you can be playing in front of 20,000 people on the weekend, and then you come home and you're like, I'm home now. Like you're just you're nobody when you're at home, if that makes sense. Exactly. And it makes the ego, it tames the ego for me.
Yeah. It's humbling.
It brings it back down, and
it does.
I think it's super important.
It is important.
I couldn't imagine being in a life where it's just around who you are as your career.
I think at some point you will, if you're just living in that way and not aware of the need to like pull out a little bit, you'll crash and burn at some point. You know, there's only so much of it you could experience.
Yeah, no, I totally agree.
My opinion.
No, I totally agree. dude, this chat has been amazing.
Likewise, man. Thank you
so much for being on. It's been an absolute pleasure.
It's been a pleasure for me as well, man. And respect to you, because guys like yourself, now I'm listening and I'm like, your last tune, man. I'm playing it in all my sets.
Thank you, man.
It's been inspiring me,
Thank you. If when I'm in New York, I'd love to get together. Let's go for dinner.
Let's do it.
Let's write some music. Let's do that. Before we go, how can people follow you? How can people check out your music and all of that?
I mean, I have a SoundCloud. I haven't shown it much love, but follow me on my Instagram, Lee Calderon. I'm not a big social media person. I hate being tethered to my phone, although I know it's fucking necessary. it's not something I'm good at. I realize it's important. I got to step up my social media game.
It's all good, man. You're doing your thing. Dude, keep safe and hopefully see you soon.
Yes, likewise, man.
Peace, man. Thank you, dude. Bye. And that's a wrap. Hope you enjoyed it. Keep safe. See you next time.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.